Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Contending for Truth Radio. This is Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. We're going to have a great show, but as always, Red Skelton, tell us about that teacher in Indiana.
I remember a teacher that I had. Now, I went through the seventh grade. I went to the seventh grade. I left home when I was 10 years old because I was hungry. I work in the summer and I go to school in the winter. But I had this one teacher. It was the principal of the Harrison School in Vincennes, Indiana. To me, this was the greatest teacher, a real sage of my time, anyhow. He had such wisdom. And we were all reciting the Pledge of Allegiance one day. And he walked over, this little old teacher, Mr. Lasswell was his name. Mr. Lasswell, he says, I've been listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word? I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity, allegiance, my love and my devotion, to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom, wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United. That means that we have all come together. States. Individual communities that have united into 48 great states. 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose, and that's love for country. And to the Republic, Republic, a state in which sovereign power is invested in representatives chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people, and it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people. For which it stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation, and justice. The principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer? And that would be eliminated from schools, too.
From the leaders to the people, not the people. From the people to the leaders, not the leaders to the people. You know, it's really a simple concept, actually. It's a concept, and you know, Dan, sometimes we wait until about 10, 15 minutes into the show before we mention the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, where those great men came together. And let me tell you, folks, I want to talk about it for a second, because it was not an easy task for them to come together, let alone alone be in that room and argue the issues at the time and come up together with that great constitution that they did. Different people. John Adams like traveled for 2 weeks in a hot summer on the East Coast, wandering around through the countryside to get there. They each did that. They sat in that hot room. They didn't have air conditioning. George Washington kind of stood at the back of the room for the most part and waited till the end before he spoke up. It's a great story. I would encourage everybody to read one of the best books I've ever read. Was The Summer of 1787 by James Collier. James Collier was also the name of my dad's fifth grade teacher, a good friend, but not the same James Collier, but so I always remember his name. But an incredible book. Dan, I don't know if you've ever read that one, but it's a must read. You will love that book. And I think you can get it used on Amazon. I don't think it's in publication anymore. But it goes into detail, not only the discussions and the issues of the day, but it also goes into detail exactly what happened in that room and from different historical documents. And they came together and they decided that in the past, nations had always gone awry because the leaders ended up being tyrants. And so they set up a situation where the government was very, very limited, where the federal government had certain things that it was good at. And we know that it's important to have a federal government. I'm a firm believer in federal government when they are in their place and they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And they said everything else should be left up to the states. I sometimes wish I could go back there and help them on that Constitution. I put another paragraph at the very beginning, right after the preamble, that says, this is simple, folks. This is simple. The federal government cannot micromanage, therefore, we're giving almost all the power to the states, and the federal government shall not infringe upon that. And here's why, and in detail the Constitution, because it's so simple. The concept is absolutely so simple. A federal government cannot micromanage. There are 300 million plus people in this country. We've got 50 different states. And for the federal government to try and make a cookie-cutter-sized setup on anything in this great country is absolutely just lack of common sense. You cannot run things in Montana like you do in New York. In fact, you can't even run things in Manhattan like you do in the rest of New York State. And so it's got to be up to the local states to decide their local problems and to deal with it to the best way that they know how. And even when we come to the state government, the state government cannot micromanage. And most states have a constitution that limit a lot of the state's power so that the local communities can control. The left wants to destroy that. They don't like that. They want to set up. They want to have a large, encumbering, overreaching government that makes all kinds of decisions because they know that the will of the people does not always agree with their side. In fact, and I'm going to tell you, folks, you look it up on the Internet. For decades, the far left, even though Barack Obama has been in power for 6 years, the far left has never been any more than 12 to 15% of the country. When they poll, the conservative belief generally is 60% of the country. Our problem is we've got a lot of conservatives not voting. And the rest consider themselves kind of middle of the ground. And I believe if you sat down and really had a discussion with those people about some basic concepts, those people would find out that they themselves are conservative. I've got a step brother. I don't know what you would call him. Up in Colorado, Tim Sparhuck, my buddy. I love him dearly. He's sister's biological brother. And he's always thinking he's a liberal until I post a Second Amendment something, and then he likes that. He wants his Second Amendment rights. And whenever he goes to post something liberal on one of my posts, I smack him back, and he just gets quiet. And when it all comes down to it, when he comes here to Texas to visit, we're going to have a talk, and he's going to come to the conclusion that really he's not a liberal. He's basically a conservative because I know where he stands on most issues. But he's young, so it's cool to be a liberal, I guess, is the situation. But, you know, it all goes back to that Constitution, and it all goes back to our freedoms. And right now, our problem, our biggest problem, is the message. We've got so many people, and I always do this. I'm going to start out the show doing this, and then I'll pass it over to Dan after we introduce our first subject. I stand here at the edge of my garage, and I look out, and I can see all these rooftops in California. I looked out at the cows across the field out here in Texas. I live in a neighborhood, and I see all the rooftops, and there's probably about 100 houses in this little neighborhood that we live in. I know that if I went into 100 of those houses and I sat down and talked about some basic principles about smaller government and large government and tyranny and control and freedom and liberty and some of the basics, I believe most of those people would agree with what I have to say. But if I walked into that same 100 houses and asked them what Benghazi was, I believe most of them would ask me, is that an Italian dessert? They have no idea what's going on in the world, and part of it is because our media doesn't cover things, which we're going to talk about here in just a second. Part of it is because our media lies, basically lies about some of these things. And so our job, Dan and I's job, is to wake up America. And we're waking up America in our own little part of the world. Dan has got a lot of connections in Florida. I've got a lot of connections in Texas. And we're working on waking up people and making sure they know what's going on. There's a horrific situation that's gone on in the last few weeks in our country. A very, very sad situation, actually, that our news media has not covered at all. There's a young man, 19 years old, named Brendan Tavlin. He was executed here in the United States on our soil by a jihadist. And it's not just speculation. This jihadist, and I'm not going to use him by name. I don't want to share his name. I want Brendan's name to be out there. Admitted in the police report, he killed him because he's at war with Christians. He's at war with those that don't agree with him. He says it was just a kill, is what he said. And our mainstream media, you know, Ferguson, a situation that I might have been on their side. I'm a firm believer that we've got some real huge overreach in our police departments. I believe we've got some abuse going on. Anybody that knows me knows that I was on the Don Miller case for a long time, and the justice was not right. But as we got into the Ferguson story, we found out this guy was an idiot criminal who got himself into a bad situation because he was doing bad things, and the cops were fully in their right to do what they needed to do to take care of the situation. They were threatened. Yet the news media was all over it. The president was all over it. But we have a young, white, good-looking, 19-year-old male starting college, a great faith, doing great things, as Michelle Malkin described it, a kid that any parent would be proud of. And he's killed, just randomly killed, in this jihad on our soil. And come to find out, this guy has murdered at least three other people. And the news media is being silent on it. News media is being silent on it. And I don't read articles very often on Blog Talk Radio. I don't like to read on the air. And that's Fridays on our ladies' Bible class. I do a lot of reading. But I'm going to read this from Michelle Malkin. For two bloody months, an armed jihadist serial killer ran loose across the country. At least four innocent men died this spring and summer as acts of vengeance on behalf of aggrieved Muslims, the self-confessed murderer has now proclaimed. Have you heard about this story? Probably not. The usual suspects who decry hate crimes and gun violence haven't uttered a peep. Why? Like O.J.'s glove, if the narrative don't fit, you must acquit. The admitted killer in this case will cast as another lone wolf. Those familiar grievances and bloodthirsty Islamic invocations mean nothing. I say enough with the whitewashing. Meet and I'm not going to say his name. His homicidal Islamic terror spree took him from coast to coast. The 29-year-old career thug admitted to killing Leroy Henderson in Seattle in April. Ahmed said, Syed Andwan Anderson Young in Seattle on June 1st, and college student Brendan Tevlin, 19, in Essex County, New Jersey on June 25th. Tevlin was gunned down in his family Jeep on his way home from a friend's house. Ballistics and other evidence leaked all the victims to Muhammad Brown. Police apprehended him last month hiding in an encampment near the Watchung Mountains of West Orange, New Jersey. While he was on the run, he disguised himself in a Muslim kafia. He carried a notebook with jihadist scribblings and advice on evading detection. I obtained the latest charging documents filed in Washington State, which detailed the defiant domestic terrorist motives. And you can read those documents. Link them to Michelle Malkins. And if you go to our Twitter on Contending for Truth Radio, you can find the article. You can find it. You'll find it soon on our Contending for Truth Radio page. But if you'll just search hashtag Brendan Devlin on Facebook or Twitter, you'll find all the information you want. Muhammad Brown told investigators that Tevlin's saying was just a kill. The devout Islamic adherent proclaimed, "My mission is vengeance, for the lives of millions are lost every day," echoing jihadist Fort Hood mass killer Nidal Hassan. Muhammad Brown cited Muslim deaths in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan as a catalyst for his one-man Islamic terror campaign. "All these lives are taken every single day by America, by this government. So a life for a life." And I'll let you go ahead and read the rest of the story. You can find it at michellemalkin.com. Michelle, boy, I have to give it to her, man. She is on some of these things that nobody else wants to cover, Dan. She's been on Common Core like a hot potato. And she'd been on this. She was one of the first ones on this. I just noticed the story a couple of days ago and have been sharing it. And it seems to be really, really picking up steam. Fox News covered it here yesterday. And social media is taking over and running with it. But we're in a situation where this is something the mainstream media should be covering. But it totally goes against the administration's still continuing to say that they are in control of the war on terror. Yet we've got this going on right now. We've got ISIS crossing the border here in Texas. We have got threats. We've got reporters being beheaded on the other side of the pond, and I'm sure that is going to start happening on this side of the pond here soon. And the president's out playing golf, basically. The left doesn't want to touch this because they know that when they start talking to the American people about these things, we unite on the side of we need to do something about it. And they are a let's not do anything about it kind of a mentality. And it's insane. So, Dan, with that, I will pass it over to you, my friend, down in Florida. I am having beautiful weather here today, Dan. It is so nice. It's kind of overcast, but the humidity is gone, and we're loving it. Dan Wilson, down in Florida.
Now, we're having a tropical low going over us right now, so humid as heck, but still nice, you know. Temperature slowly dropping, which is a good thing, and we'll be enjoying the real wonderful Florida weather in about a month, so I'm looking forward to that. And as for this incident, my question is, how many more are happening that we don't know about? You know, because I don't even want to call him our president. I'm embarrassed to say it. Refuses to close our borders and is allowing these murderers into our country to kill our people who have done nothing wrong. I mean, what kind of crap is this? You know, he calls himself a Christian, yet does everything he can to help the Muslims. He's a backstabbing SOB who needs to be thrown in jail. And I wish Congress would have enough nerve to do something about it. And, you know, more and more of the country knows this. And I am sick of him. I'm sick of our quote-unquote attorney general, our secretary of state. They're all a joke. You know, they're going in on this thing with ISIS saying we're going to do airborne attacks only with no boots on the ground. Well, how the heck do you know where your targets are? I just wrote an article on this, and, you know, the best intel is the intel you get when you're down there and you see it, or you get it right from the people and it's minutes old. When the CIA does their intel, you know, it might be 26 hours. And, you know, that's not going to help you in a real combat situation. Even if the, you know, the CIA does a real good job and gets it in immediately, it's an hour before it gets to the troops. I mean, it's stupid. The only way you're going to know what the heck's going on to have effective airstrikes is by having people on the ground. And the only way you're going to stop these SOBs is by tracking them right there. You're going to have to be right there in the field until you can, you know, so you can track them down. And this president doesn't have a clue about how to run a war. He doesn't have a clue. He doesn't have a heart. I mean, because he literally sets up our own people to be killed. SEAL Team 6 is no longer. Do you know how many people know that? Very, very few. They think just a helicopter crashed. Yeah, that helicopter crashed. 38 people died in that helicopter. 22 of them were members of SEAL Team 6, the one who took out Obama, Bin Laden. And it didn't even get mentioned on the news. I mean, that's shameful. And that's the way, you know, our government's been going for way too long. This president should be tried for treason and thrown in jail, along with his top four, actually. Clinton belongs in jail as well, because she's the one that actually refused to give the order so that the two Apaches take out the terrorists that shot down SEAL Team 6. But do we hear any of this? No. The only way you're going to get this information is for people like us. You know, it's otherwise you aren't going to get it. You're going to have to get it through the underground media. And thank God we have this so we can share the news with you. It's very, very frustrating. And I just wish more people would be listening to this. You know, even The Blaze is not mentioning Extortion 17 and what happened to SEAL Team 6. And it's sad. It's sad that people are, you know, being forced, the media is being forced to keep these things hidden. And now we have jihadists in our own country killing people. You know, how long is this going to last? And are we going to allow people to get away with this? I'll tell you this much. I ever see one of the SOBs ever pull out a gun, they're going to be looking at a 45, and I'm going to pull the trigger before they will. I mean, this is ridiculous. And then our government's taking away our rights to bear arms so the Muslims can kill us easier. It's ridiculous. Our government today is a sham. It's embarrassing. And I can't say too many good things about it right now. You know, at least at one time I could say something good about the Republicans. I can't do that anymore. I can't say anything good about either side. This is ridiculous. And that's why this come November, we need each and every one of you to do your research and then get out there and vote. Make sure you vote for conservatives who are going to do what we the people want, not what they want to do. The faster we get rid of these, you know, rhinos, and the faster we get rid of these far left, the better off we are. I am getting so tired of this. And every day, you hear on the news what's going on. You know, we fight for Iraq. We win the war, well, we defeat the enemy, and what do? We allow the jihadists to take over. The day we left, they were still setting off IEDs. That means our job wasn't done. And the same thing is going on in Afghanistan. And they say our job is done. What a crock of baloney. You know, people don't even know. The last time we fought a war correctly was World War II. You know, you hear these people saying, oh, we can't, you know, you can't kill civilians. You can't do this. You can't cross this line. You can't cross that line. Well, here's a rude awakening, people. Innocent people die in war. Jesus Christ even mentioned it. It's part of it. That's part of war. It's not a good part of war, but it's part of war. How do you defeat an enemy? You get them to a point where they don't want to fight anymore. And that includes the people. And you come in there, and yeah, you do the carpet bombing. you go out there and level it, the people, the civilians are going to be taking cover. The only people you're going to be out there fighting you is the enemy, and they're the ones you want. And you go after them, and once you destroy their infrastructure, destroy their ability to wage war, to the point where they've had it, and they refuse, they don't want to fight anymore. Then you come in, you get the confidence of the people, you have diplomats rebuilding the government, and then you have, beginning with the Army Corps of Engineers, who, along with civilians, start building up their infrastructure and get their country on their feet and functional. If you don't do it, you have what's happening in Iraq right now. Now, we've fought since World War II. We went to Korea. The best we could pull off was a tie. Went to Vietnam, we lost. And we can't say we've won anything even in the last few years. We win it and then we give it right back to them. And when's this stupidity going to stop? You know, we have to get out there. You're going to have to accept facts. There's no such thing as a clean war or a surgical war, because unless you get the people to be angry enough at the military to tell them to stop, then this is just going to keep on going on and on and on and on. It's going to be like a broken record. It'll just keep on skipping back right to where we start. We got to go in there with force, finish the job, make it so they don't want to fight anymore. Then you bring in more troops, weed out the those who refuse to give up. And in the meantime, you get the soldiers to show the people that we aren't bad, that the propaganda they gave us, them, was a bunch of baloney. Then we rebuild their infrastructure, rebuild their government, and then we leave a few bases back there to let the rest of the world know that if they mess with these people, they're messing with us. And then all of a sudden you got an ally. By doing it the way we've been doing it for the last 50 years, all you do is piss everybody off. And we got to wake up and start realizing it. No, war rots. But if we took care of things, you know something? We'd be so much further ahead of the game right now. And what would we be doing? We'd be spreading freedom throughout the world. Not allowing communism and socialism to take over. Well, I think I've ranted for enough for a little bit, so I'll pass it back to you, Scott.
That's what we do, Dan, is we rant. And it's so true. And you know, Dan, I've said this before, and I'm gonna say it again. It really comes back down to some really basic, simple premises. That's why I don't understand the left, because they can't argue. We know that. That's why they use a lot of ad hominem attacks and name-calling and racism and all these things, because they don't want to discuss the actual debate. But it really, all you got to do is compare two different types of leaders. And we've had Jimmy Carter, we've had Barack Obama, that's one kind of leader. We've got Ronald Reagan, who was another type of leader. And I didn't always agree with George Bush. I got some huge problems with George Bush, especially when it comes to more of the world controlling things. But he was firm and he was resound. And when you stand in the office of the presidency of the United States and you come out and approach it from a weak standpoint, and when you come out and you say, I don't have a plan, we don't have a strategy yet, that's a weak standpoint. You don't ever say that. That was the dumbest thing he said in 6 years, and he said a lot of dumb things. Then you end up having chaos, and it's really, really simple. You can take it right down to a schoolyard. Of course, the schools anymore with Common Core and all the crazy testing that they're having to do have almost gotten rid of recess. But if you have a schoolyard and you've got a bunch of kids and you've got somebody that's firm out there that is consistent, that the kids know if you get out of line, there is going to be a consequence, you have pretty much general peace on the schoolyard. If you throw a brand new teacher out there that doesn't know anything about consistency, doesn't know how to stand firm, is kind of wishy-washy, you're going to begin to have chaos on the schoolyard. It's really simple. You can take it into an office. If you've got a weak manager in the office who kind of, you know, doesn't care about the rules, kind of lets everybody kind of do their own thing, and really there's no consequences for any kind of action, you begin to have chaos even in an adult office. If you've got a strong, and sometimes a manager's got to be tough. I was never a good manager. I've got managerial skills, but I was never a good manager. I'm too soft-hearted. I always made a better business owner and let somebody else be the toughie. But if you have that situation as the President of the United States, this is what we end up with. And I'm not a believer in blaming everything on Barack Obama. He's got a whole team of people on the left that are doing a lot of these things. In fact, I'd rather he stayed playing golf. But one thing that you can directly pin on Barack Obama, 100%, is his appearance of weakness on the world stage is causing this chaos directly. Because people are not afraid. They're not worried. They know that he's not going to do anything. So they're going to go ahead and do anything. And the world has always been that way. That's history. You can go back through decades and centuries and thousands of years of history, and it proves it correct. You've got a strong leader, you're gonna have a lot more peace. You know, there is a lot to be said for peace through strength. Ronald Reagan carried a big stick. And because of that, we had peacetime prosperity. We basically, during those years, didn't have a whole lot of craziness going on in the world. Right now, the whole world is falling apart. And it's really, really, you know, kind of a simple concept. It kind of, the same thing goes on in a home. I tend to be a toughie. I'm very loving with my girls, and they know. I tell them every day, more than once a day, how much I love them and how proud I am of them. But at the same time, I've got rules, and when you break those rules, there's consequences. I've got one niece that's sitting in her room right now. She broke one of the rules. She's going to stay in that room for a little while. I told her to go ahead and clean the room up while she was there. And if I didn't do that, I'd begin to have chaos. They would tend to disrespect me. They would tend to just kind of do whatever they wanted to do. And as they became teenagers, it would get worse. And as they went into their adult life, they would have the mentality of, I can do anything they want. They would lose their job. Their marriage wouldn't last very long. With that kind of a mentality, you begin to have chaos. And I don't understand how a full-grown man like Barack Obama doesn't understand this. The one good thing I can say about Barack Obama is he seems to be a pretty good dad. And I'm sure that if he ran his household, if he dealt with his daughters in the same method that he's dealing with the world, we would see all kinds of chaos coming out of that family. But he obviously doesn't do that. They seem to be pretty good girls that were raised with some pretty firm standards and consequences, at least from all appearances. And it's really, you know, Dan, I guess that's what makes me the angriest, is that they don't see this. I'm not talking about rocket science here. I'm not talking about something that takes a lawyer to understand or a doctor to understand or a philosopher to understand. These are basic world principles. and they don't get it. And so, therefore, we have these situations. But really, when it all comes down to it, he's getting what he wants. He wants chaos. The left relies on chaos. Look at what it took Fidel Castro to take over Cuba. It's insane. And, you know, as I stand out here and I look over the beautiful trees, and it's so beautiful here in Texas, we've still got things blooming here. It's a beautiful place to live. And we are in a state that is really basically turning redder because the people in Texas understand some of these basic concepts. They raise their kids right here in Texas. Kids are respectful here in Texas for the most part. And it's not perfect. No place has ever been. But it's a lot better in California where most children have not been taught any respect whatsoever. And the people are respectful to each other. And you've got a semblance of peace that I feel here in Texas living on a daily basis. We've got strong churches here, and most people attend church of some kind. And we are really living the American dream here in Texas. We're the number one state to do business. Businesses are flocking in here. They're even coming from Florida, Dan, the number two state. That's how good Texas is. And not only that, Dan, I hear that the Cowboys left Florida and the Texas Longhorns left Florida to come to Texas, or left Florida to come to Texas. So, but you know,
well, we still have our cows.
Have basically the same, a lot of the same qualities down there in Florida. You've got a constituency down there that is a lot of older people and a lot of younger, transient type people, kids that move in for a few years and go to work and enjoy the Florida dream for a little while. In fact, the stats are, Dan, or the stats were when I lived there, that 9 out of 10 people who visit Florida eventually move there for at least some time. And you and I are still living the American dream, but you can go places like California or New York where they are really telling you how to live your life. We had Jennifer Cavaney, my new sister from another mother, who is a regular on, she calls in each week on the Conover U show on Thursdays. She's the editor of the College Fix, and she deals with a lot of college-level situations going on, especially when it comes to morality. And we talked this last Thursday about a bill that California is trying to get passed where two students in college have to almost sign documents that it's okay to have sex. Now, as an uncle slash parent, I'm not saying that as a parent might not be a really good idea. I don't believe that it's a good idea to have sex when you're not married. It's damaging. But they're trying to micromanage everybody's life. To build a house out in California is almost insane anymore. The housing industry is really, really suffering because the EPA and the leftist green organizations have gotten together and made it where you have to add all these things that are not necessary to building a house that have raised the prices, and it's just insane. New York City, there for a while, you couldn't even get anything more than a 16-ounce soft drink because the state said it's not good for you. We've got Michelle Obama, who's really being slapped back pretty hard, basically trying to control what our kids eat, and not only control what they eat at school, what's served to them, but what the parents bring to them. And that's not what this country's all about. It is insane what the left really wants to do. And that's why, folks, it's important, very, very important, that you wake up your neighbors, that you explain these things, you explain where Barack Obama wants to go. Of course, you're going to be called a conspiracy theorist because they have to throw names because they can't argue it. They can't come out and say, "This here's proof that you're wrong." All they can do is call names. But we got to get out. We can talk to the guy in the supermarket. Talk to the lady in the supermarket while you're waiting in line. When you're getting your hair done, talk to the lady that's doing your hair. Talk to your neighbors and explain to them exactly where the left wants to go. And if you don't know, then you need to study some history. And it'll tell you really, really quick. You know, Dan, I think it's been a couple of weeks since we talked about those that are swimming south of you in shark-infested waters for 90 miles. They're only swimming one way. They're leaving Cuba to come to the United States. I'm afraid one of these days, Dan, it might be my nieces swimming from Florida to Cuba. Because that's where we're heading. And with that, I got to go deal with Millie for a second here. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Dan, to go back to Randy.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, another thing is, right up until, well, the last 10 years, you know, Canadians used to come down to the States to do their shopping because our taxes were lower. And the same thing with filling up their tanks, you know, in their cars. And now it's just the opposite. We're going to Canada because they have fewer taxes than we do. I mean, and it's getting worse by the day. You know, we just got a tax increase in my little county here, in Pasco County, that they're adding another 5 cents per gallon on a tank of gas. Because they said they can't operate in their budget. Well, you know why? Because they haven't really sat down and worked out a good workable budget. You know, it's real simple. If you can't, you know, if here, you know, at home, if you don't have the money in your checking account or, you know, your savings account to back it up, you don't buy it. It's a real simple concept. And the federal government has to work the same way. Same as the state government and same as the county government. Instead, they keep on spending until they don't have any more money, and then they take more money from us. You know, the federal government, when they take your taxes, your return after they're done with all their playing everything, for every dollar you give the federal government in taxes, you receive 10 cents in return. That means 90% of that money goes everywhere but where it's supposed to go. Now, don't you think that we could do a lot better if the federal government let us keep that dollar? Do you think that, you know, our economy would be better? The last people you want to give money to is federal government, because they have no idea how to manage money. Or they actually do. Yeah, the way they manage money is buy each other off, add up all these stupid programs that are absolutely useless, and, you know, they waste it. We have a, you know, Nancy Pelosi, when she retires, will be getting $800,000 a year.
Insane.
That is ridiculous. She's not worth $80 a year. I mean,
and you know what's even more ridiculous is we know that there is a huge discrepancy between a liberal and a conservative on how much money they give to charity. And we know that the huge bulk of that money is going to be kept in her pocket. And she's going to give to charity just as much as she can give that helps her on her taxes, no more, no less. And, you know, Dan, I'll throw this back to you after say this, but, you know, you brought up a really important topic called taxes. And I have had a solution for years, and I can't seem to get anybody to pick up on it. I think I'm going to have to start telling every single one of my candidates that I support, here's my tax plan. And I am a firm believer that we need to take the power of collecting the taxes entirely away from the federal government. Let the states collect all the taxes, and then the states can give to the federal government what the federal government needs. And I think if you just switched that process of the federal government collecting it, and then it sends back to the states and goes back and forth, and the money being doled out, if the states just collected their own tax, and then they can accomplish what they need to accomplish and then give to the federal government what the federal government needs, and then highways and different things that they need to take care of, they can take care of. And then if the states are controlling the purse, when the federal government doesn't have all that free money just coming in, they will have to cut down the waste, fraud, and abuse. And a wealthy state like Texas could give their percentage. A smaller state like Rhode Island. Rhode Island's still there, right?
small.
But I've been a believer for a long time, and I'm a fair tax guy and this and that, but I've really always believed that if you just made that one little switch where the states did all the collecting of whatever taxes they need to collect, and then they give to the federal government, the state gives the money to the federal government, I think you would solve a multitude of problems. I'll pass it back to you.
No, I agree. I mean, if you want to lose money, give it to the federal government. As I said, the return on investment is you give them a dollar, they give you a dime. I mean, that's ridiculous. But that's fact. I mean, it not only is wasted money, it's money that is taken out of the economy, which harms the economy. It doesn't benefit anybody really in particular, except for the people who are putting it in their pockets. I mean, it's a... Excuse me. It's a total sham. And this is why I'd like to see somebody get into the presidency who's going to get rid of them, all those stupid departments that are doing absolutely nothing, that are hiring, that have hired hundreds of thousands of people. If we do that alone, we can support the programs that are needed and lower taxes at the same time. Instead, the federal government just keeps on taking and taking and taking and taking, and they're giving nothing in return. I mean, it's taxes drive me nuts. It's the biggest sham that has ever happened, has ever been perpetrated on this country. And then they have this crap going on about global warming, the biggest lie that's ever been traded on this world. And they keep on pushing for that, which is more money in their pocket and less money in ours. The best people who know how to manage money is you and I, are the people, we the people. It's not the government. The government has proven time and time again they don't have the ability to manage money. And it's time that, you know, we started getting our money back so we can manage it. We'd have a heck of a lot healthier economy, and our country would be doing a lot better. And then we have this stupid president who would never follow through on anything. He said he was going to deal with the border issue before November. Excuse me. And what did he do? He puts it off. And now the promise is the end of the year. And come the end of the year, he'll come up with some other excuse. Just like his decisions with the on an international basis. This president can't stand up for anything. I mean, and then when he wants his bills passed, he knows they won't get passed. So what does he do? He does it behind the back. They just did a major thing on the Second Amendment, taking about half of our rights away on the Second Amendment. Where do they do that? Behind closed doors. And for one thing, it's constitutionally illegal. But does he care? No. Does Congress care? No. This is why we need to do some major spring cleaning here, folks. Even though it starts in November, we need to get rid of these people that don't care about our Constitution, don't care about our country. We need that conservative attitude. These people have to, whoever we elect, has to believe in God first, our Constitution second, and tied with that, our country. These are the three things that need to be considered. And if they don't have allegiance to those three things, then they don't belong in office. Our Constitution was divinely inspired. And I don't care what anybody says. You can call me a nut, whatever. I don't care. But it was God who was guiding Thomas Jefferson's hand. It was God who led the Constitutional Convention. And that was also proven. Benjamin Franklin's two greatest speeches, in my opinion, was the address to Congress, requiring prayer, and his closing address to Congress on the Constitutional Convention. And I recommend people read both. Those are the two greatest speeches I've been given. And it's because, you know something, this country is based on these founding principles. And when you remove our foundation, what happens when you remove a foundation from a house? It falls down. What happens when you remove a foundation from a country? It's going to collapse. What's happening to our company, our country? It's collapsing. And they blame it on everything but where the actual blame belongs. You know, now they're hiding, radical Muslims killing Americans on our own soil. Now, what's wrong with this? You know, I recommend that we all boycott the major networks. with the exception of Fox, because they're finally starting to talk about it. But all the rest of the networks, you got 300 channels to pick from. ABC, CBS, and NBC, we can do without. And I'm recommending to all of you is to stop watching those three networks and watch whatever else you want, as long as they aren't owned by any of those three corporations. You know, let's fight back. You know, they have freedom of the press, and they have the right to broadcast what they want. But we have freedom of choice. And you know something? That's what's great about this country. The people have a lot of power. If we don't listen to those three networks, guess what? Their advertisers go away. Once their advertisers go away, there's no money coming into their company. So then they have two choices. Either they change their ways or they go out of business. And frankly, I could care less if those three networks went out of business. Wouldn't bother me. It wouldn't hurt my feelings. You know, think about it. We have that power. You know, this is our broadcasts are getting out to quite a few people. And think about it. Try to do it without listening to those three networks. You know, let's start taking, you know, the bull by the horns, and these mainstream media outlets who refuse to tell us what's going on in this country, let's ignore them. You have a bunch of us. You have a bunch of networks down here in the underground that are easy to listen to. Anybody with a computer can listen to it. Spread the word to your friends. We have a wonderful syndicator that we're part of called the Pundit Press. They have radio shows all day long. They have TV, everything that you know you'd want from a regular network, and you're going to get more accurate information, and you're going to get it faster than you ever would with the three major networks. Now, I'd rather get the truth than a bunch of lies and a bunch of propaganda that's being fed to them by the far left. Most of the radio stations here will yell at the right as fast as we'll yell at the left, because the truth is what's... The truth stands by itself. And we can tell the truth. And I'd rather have the truth than a bunch of lies. With that, I'll pass it back to you, Scott.
Well, and you know, that's what it all comes down to, Dan, is truth. And it's important. And I want to take us a turn a little bit because, you know, Dan, this weekend marks the 200th anniversary of the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner. And it's not only our national anthem. You know, that flag, that Star-Spangled Banner, it flew during the War of 1812, during the Battle of Baltimore at Fort McHenry.
And it inspired Francis Scott Key to write those beautiful words. They would become our national anthem. And that flag, as Sid Miller just posted, has flown all over the world as a symbol of freedom and liberty. It has draped caskets of brave men and women who have given their life for this country. And it is a symbol. It's a special symbol of hope, like the world has never, ever seen. And so I want to play this. I pulled this up, and so I'm going to let it just describe itself. We're going to take a little bit of time, and then we can talk about that flag.
We are honored to have our national anthem sung by the combined choir, the United States Naval Academy, the United States Air Force Academy, United States Military Academy at West Point, United States Coast Guard Academy, and accompanied by the United States Army Herald Trumpet.
Yo, Obama, that flag is still there. And let me tell you, folks, if that doesn't bring a tear to your eye, I don't know what will. That's what Dan and I are all about, right there. That's the foundation. That flag stands for everything that we talk about. That flag stands for our Second Amendment rights, our First Amendment rights, all of our amendment rights. That flag stands for our Constitution. That flag stands for the entrepreneurial spirit. That flag stands for the men and women who have given their lives to promote freedom and liberty and to fight tyranny. That flag stands for the house you live in, the car you drive, the televisions that are in your house. That flag stands for your lifestyle. That flag stands for your ability to worship the way you would see fit. I would tell you to worship the way God sees fit. But you've got the freedom to worship as you would see fit. That flag stands for that. That flag stands for all the liberals' freedom to spout the pablum that they spout. That flag stands for the freedom for them to call me a racist, even though I am not. That flag stands for 200 and almost 50 years of this country's greatness and the people all over the world that have benefited from this great experiment called the United States of America. That flag stands for the people in Grenada who are living back in freedom now because Fidel Castro was kicked out by Ronald Reagan. The flag stands for freedom in many places like Germany and Japan and Canada, who have relied on us to defend them. This flag stands for our ability to stand here on Blog Talk Radio in our garages, in our garage, in Dan in his home, talking about these issues. And 200 years ago, Francis Scott Key penned those words. It became our national anthem. And those words are so true. There's actually a movement out there by the liberals to get rid of the national anthem. They don't like it. It's not politically correct, they don't think. Well, that flag stands for the freedom for them to believe that and to fight for it. And I'm all for them. Fight for it. Go ahead. I don't think you're going to win. We've got the freedom in this country. If you believe something like that, you can stand out on the street corner and yell it if you want. And I am glad to let you do that, as wrong as you are, because that's what makes this nation great. Our constitutional rights weren't designed for when things are in perfection. Our constitutional rights were designed for when things are not in perfection. My freedom of speech wasn't designed to protect me to say, oh, Barack Obama is a wonderful person. My freedom of speech was designed for me to say he's an idiot. Because in other nations, when you called your president an idiot, they could come and take you away with guns and shoot you. We've got that freedom. I love Ronald Reagan. I'll fight to the death for your right, if you're a liberal, to not like him and to say mean things about him. I think you're wrong. I think you're misinformed. I think you need to do a little bit of soul-searching and examining and find out what truth is. But I'll defend your right. Chris Matthews, I can't stand. Todd, I can't stand. Some of these new media guys that are idiots, Tourette, we could just think of many of them. I disagree with them wholeheartedly on almost 100% of everything they say, although Chris Matthews recently, in the last year and a half, has really kind of lost his tingle up his leg for President Obama. But that flag stands for freedom for them to say incredibly stupid things. And I'll fight for that freedom. 200 years, folks, we've been singing those songs, that song. And what an incredible thing. You can look it up on YouTube. I just posted it on my Facebook page. But the U.S. National Anthem by the Academy Choirs, all of our armed services choirs singing that together, that great song. And yes, Barack Obama, that flag is still there. You may not like it. You may not respect it. That flag is still there, and it is still flying, and it flies high over houses and schools and businesses and churches all over the country. You know, Dan, this week we celebrated Patriot Day, September 11th. It's hard to believe it's 13 years past. You know, when I was a kid, I always knew what December 7th was. And we would have not had very many days in our history where we really, really remember the day that something happened. And we really basically have two, Pearl Harbor and September 11th, two times when on our own shores, horrific amounts of deaths due to the behest of people that don't like us. And we celebrated 9/11 this week. And I remember, Dan, when 9/11 happened. I was living in Florida, and I was working in Grenada and Trinidad. I actually was not living, per se, in Florida much. I come home and get on, sometimes walk through the airport and get back on the plane and go back, because I had to come back every 3 months. But I happened to be home from Grenada and Trinidad and had flown directly from Trinidad up to I take that back. That was another trip. I drove up to Lexington, Kentucky, to see some friends. I used to live in Evansville, Indiana, and I had stopped in Evansville for about a week and visited with friends there, and then gone on to Lexington, Kentucky, on Sunday night, and I woke up the next morning, and my friend Lori says, "Scott, you've got to get up. You've got to see what's on the news." And the first tower had been hit. and we sat there and we watched the news. My hand just continued to stay over my mouth. I just couldn't believe what was going on. And at the time, we didn't know how the day's plan, how the day's events were gonna play out. But we knew that there was severe damage and many deaths at the top of that first tower that was hit. And then as we watched, we saw that second plane hit the tower and live on television, and I saw our reaction the same as the news media's reaction. They said, it's been hit. In fact, when it's been hit, this is definitely a terrorist attack. And then we watched one by one those towers fall. And over the next few weeks, we watched the news reports for days and days and days. That was all that was on the news. Was just solid 9/11 and the rubble and President Bush getting up and giving his famous speech and learning the names of the victims and learning what happened on the planes, learning about the flight in Pennsylvania where they said, let's roll, and they took that plane down so that it wouldn't do more damage. It was most likely headed for the Capitol or for the White House. We sat and we watched, and as that morning went on, my two friends that I was staying with are kind of liberal. Okay, so they're a whole lot liberal, but they were good friends, and we talked politics on an occasion, and it didn't work out really well. But we were all united on that day, and as the day went on, we began to understand that gas might go up to $5, $6, $7 a gallon. Who would have thought a few years later it'd be up there anyways? But we were worried about gas lines and transportation. And so finally, Lori says, we have to leave the house. We have to go. Just a second. We left the house and went out and got in a gas line and sat for an hour waiting to fill up the tanks and gas to make sure we had gas for the few days. And then we went driving around Lexington, Kentucky, one of my favorite cities. In fact, I love living in Texas, but I've always said if I had to pick one city, not depending on the state, one city to live in, it would be Lexington, Kentucky. It's a beautiful city. Drive around the horse farms. And so we took a drive. We drove out around the horse farms, and we went downtown to the university area and had a cup of coffee and sat and visited for a while and drove around. And as we drove around throughout the day, the flags started appearing. And the next day we went out and drove around again, and there was even more. And within 3 days, there was a flag almost in front of every single house. They were up and down the roads. I've never seen so many flags, Dan, in my entire life. That flag stood for freedom in those days. That flag was a comfort. It wasn't about 3 days later that they did a poll, and George Bush had 89% popularity support. The country came together. They stood behind the president because they knew that the days moving on were going to be tough days. Fortunately, the American memory is not so much as an elephant's. And he had to deal with certain things. And a lot of people have a lot of things to say about Iraq. But, you know, it was really basically simple. Iraq was understood to have weapons of mass destruction by the whole world. The French believed it. John Kerry believed it. Everybody believed it. And we knew that we had changed course in the world. And anybody that had weapons of mass destruction that were willing to give them to terrorists could be a threat to the United States. And we went throughout those next few years, and life really changed that day. It really did. We've got pre-9/11, we lived one kind of life. We've got post-9/11, we've lived another kind of life. And in some ways, we overreacted. I believe the Patriot Act went way too far. It was an overreaction, and I believe we're facing the problems of that today with the Obama administration. They're abusing it. But that flag was there. Remember seeing the flags draped around the World Trade Center area where those two buildings had fallen. So for 200 years, that flag has stood for something very, very, very special. it represents so many important things. And it's times like September 11th when those things really show. I often say, and you hear me say it all the time, if you know me, you know this is one of my biggies. It's hurdles, and it's the hurdles where we gain our strength, and it's the hurdles where we show our true character. You know, our everyday life, we don't show our character of our country when we go to a football game or when we go to Disneyland or Yosemite, or we enjoy the things of life, the Super Bowl, the nice and good things in the United States. We don't show our character there. We show our character when things get tough, when things get difficult. The United States showed our character on December 7th, 1941. On September 11th, 2001. That's when we show our character. And that's what that flag represents. That flag represents that character, the strength of the American psyche, the concept of man being smart enough to live on his own and not have to have a federal government telling us what to do at every turn. We've got a side of politics, folks, that is in control right now that doesn't believe that. They don't believe that. They believe that the only way to make life fair is if the federal government controls everything and makes it fair. They believe the only way you're going to make the American people 100% healthy is if they control what you eat and what you do and how you live. And that's not what that flag stands for. That flag stands for freedom, liberty, justice, and sacrifice. You know, this last week I've been teaching Natalia the Pledge of Allegiance. And we start, of course, with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag by Red Skelton each week. And, you know, we looked over that flag and we talked about what those stars mean and the stripes, the red stripes, you know, that basically represent blood. They represent sacrifice. The white stripes represent purity. We've got 13 of them representing the 13 original colonies. 50 stars that represent the 50 states of this great union. That flag stands for something. I'm going to have my nieces say the Pledge of Allegiance. And you can do the Texas one. Come around here, Natalia. Natalia's been learning this week. In fact, it's like if you follow my post, we've got Natalia reading the Pledge of Allegiance because she's reading very, very good. At 5 years of age, she's reading about third grade level. So proud of her. But I want my nieces to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and then Millie wants to say, we have something special here in Texas. I don't know if you have a Pledge of Allegiance to the Florida flag. I know we didn't in California, but here in Texas we have that. So go ahead.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Honor the Texas flag. I pledge allegiance to the Texas, one state, under God, one indivisible.
Very good. That's what it's all about, folks. You know, in our schools, Millie's still you say the pledge every day. Millie says the pledge every day. We do that here in Texas. That's one of the reasons why Barack Obama doesn't like Texas. In California, most of the time, they don't ever even say it anymore. But that's what this is all about. And it's important. And with that, Dan, I'll pass it back to you. Dan?
Pardon. Sorry, I was patient.
That's okay.
Can you repeat that?
I was just asking that. You had the girls say the Pledge of Allegiance, and that's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I can't even see how anybody would stand up against it. you know, it's, you know, the pledge and our Star-Spangled Banner, you know, are the two foundations of this nation. You know, when you pledge allegiance to the flag, you're pledging something far greater than just a piece of material with some colors on it. You're preaching, you're pledging a way of life. You're pledging a symbol. You know, that's why it's asking you. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And it's, you know, it's saying I'm pledging to my nation and to the republic, to the government for which it stands. One nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And think of those last three words. Liberty and justice for all. I mean, this is what makes this country so great. Because we have some people that try to keep racism alive. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Barack Obama. But racism is pretty much gone. Are we ever going to get away with it completely? You'll never get rid of anything completely. There'll be idiots out there no matter what we do. But the vast majority of Americans today are not racist. They have friends from all walks of life and from all parts of the world. I know what I do. I know Scott does. And Jennifer and Wayne Dupree and Kay Carl. We have friends from all over. And we don't judge a person by what they look like. We judge a person by what's inside. And that's what's so beautiful about this nation. If you want to know the experiment, there it is. Is that we're a nation consisting of people from all over the world, and we live in harmony. There's your great experiment. We're a nation where all men are created equal. And this truth is to be held to self-evident. And this is what, you know, no matter where you go in the world, you're not going to find the freedoms that you have here in the United States. Even our closest allies, you know, England, they have the social separations, you know, poor, middle class, upper middle class, and rich. And you can't break from one class to another. If your father was a ditch digger, you're going to be a ditch digger. And it's starting to change a little, but for the most part, that's the way it is. It's even worse in France. Germany, thank God, after the war, took us 10 years, but they adopted our ideas. So they have more freedom. Japan is still, sadly, they still have their race, their socioeconomic divides, and so does most of the other countries in the world. There are exceptions, but here in the United States, a man who didn't even own his body became the top 3%, wrote 3 books, was an advisor to 5 presidents. Now, if you can't tell me everything, things are not possible in this country, I'll tell you when that happened. The person I'm talking about was born in 1826. And the first president he was advisor to was Abraham Lincoln. In the first 20 years of his life, he lived as a slave. Yet he died in the top 3%. Do you think the Rockefellers came over here, Rich? Or the Vanderbilts, or all the big names we know today, you know, as the ultra-rich, Kennedys, and all those. They were immigrants. They were poor immigrants. But they had, you know, they had the will, the desire, and the ability to make it to the top. And this country allows you to go as far as you yourself are capable of doing. Not many countries can say that. Not many countries can we stand up and say Barack Obama is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. Without being thrown in jail. I can say Hillary Clinton belongs in jail. And I can call my congressman or my senator. You know, this is what's so beautiful about this country, is that we can say what we want. We have that freedom. I have the freedom to carry my 1911 Colt 45 along with me on my side. I have the freedom when someone comes knocking on my door, demands entry, I can say no. I have the freedom, if I'm in court, if I don't want to say something about myself, I can choose to invoke my Fifth Amendment rights. We have from my house, I have the right to say, get off my property. Because my property is sovereign, as is my house, as is our town, as is our state, and right up to our country. We have sovereignty that goes to the individual right on up. That's the 10th Amendment. You know, this is the beauty behind this country, is we have a government and a constitution that puts the power within the people, not the power with the government. And the stuff that's going on right now, that our government's telling us what we can and can't do, it's constitutionally illegal. And we have safeguards for that. And it looks like we're going to have to wait for the last one. And that's waiting until we can vote them out. And if worse comes to worse, we have another. We have a safeguard for that too. We can hold a constitutional convention. We can go out, the people, without the government, can say, we want to change it. So that we have many, many ways of saving our country. This is the greatest country that was ever to be on the face of this earth. Because no other country can match what we offer. And trust me, I've been to a lot of different countries. And why do you think everybody wants to come here? When they were behind the Iron Curtain, where do those people want to go? Do they want to stay behind the Iron Curtain? They wanted to escape. Where did they want to escape to? The United States. Cuban is 90 miles away. Where do they want to escape? They'll do anything to cross that 90-mile stretch. People, swam and kicked and paddled. They've come out of the water in Key West with jellyfish stings all over their bodies. Many of them didn't make it because they became dinner for a shark. They come from all over the world. They come from North Korea. They come from North Vietnam. They come from Russia. They come from everywhere. Why? Because this is a land of opportunity. And right now we're allowing our government to take that away from us. Because we are asleep. And now we have to wake up and we got to spread the word. Because if we don't, we'll be losing our country in a very, very, very short time. Please, please, everybody, spread the word. You're in the grocery store, spread the word. When you're getting your car washed, spread the word. Doesn't take much. You can just knock up a conversation with somebody. Not difficult to do. I do it all the time. I mean, then I'm a gimp. So if I can do it, you can do it too. So back to you.
And you know, Dan, I want to bring somebody up, and I want to talk about hurdles for a moment. And I got a reason for doing that. I'm not going to call out the reason. You and I are Frederick Douglass Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why we're Frederick Douglass Republicans is we believe in the character of that man. And I'm going to tell you the story of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was a hurdle jumper, not a hurdle crier. There's two different types of people in this world. There's the kind of people, and we all have hurdles, every single one of us, no matter what color you are, black, white. Some people have more hurdles than others. Some people have hurdles that are placed in front of them, which have not been fair. We had slavery in this country. It was a totally abomination. There's different countries in the world where Christians are facing the same hurdles. Since the beginning of time, certain men and women have had more control over other men and women. That's the history of man. There's nothing that you can do about that but try and change it on your own level. And as a Christian man, I'm a firm believer that everybody is equal. Everybody has the same ability to do their best and to jump their hurdles. And you're born and you go through life and you have hurdles and then you die, basically. And it's all how you handle those hurdles. Now, the Bible says that you use those hurdles to gain strength. That's where you gain your strength. But you've got some people that cry in front of their hurdles and blame other people for their hurdles. And then you've got the other kind of people that jump their hurdles. And Frederick Douglass was a hurdle jumper. Here's the hurdles he jumped. Frederick Douglass went from being born into slavery, losing his mother at six, to being in the top 3% of wealth in the nation. He was an author. He had the ear of presidents. Now, how do you do that? How do you do that? Only in this great nation could you do that. And you know, here's how Frederick Douglass did that. It was about his mentality. He wasn't a, well, everybody else has got the power kind of a thing. I've got my own life to live, and no matter what my hurdles are, I'm going to jump them to the best of my ability. You're Jesse Jackson, you're now Sharpton. They say just the opposite. Blame everybody else, cry, let's give you something, and let's take away all the hurdles. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery when he was 6 years old. His mother died. And he was raised in a slave household. And one day, the master's wife decided she was going to teach Frederick Douglass to read. The master came in and said, oh, no, you can't teach that child to read. If you teach that child to read, you'll ruin him as a slave. And instead of Frederick Douglass crying in front of his hurdles and blaming the white man, blaming the slave master, Frederick Douglass did the right thing, and he went, And he turned lemons into lemonade. He said, you mean to tell me if I learn how to read, I can get myself out of this situation? And he did. And not only did he learn how to read, boy, he worked really, really hard at it. And he talked his little white friends into letting him do their homework for them. And he did everything he could do to study and to learn and to better himself. He became a business owner. He became a writer. And like I said, when he died, he had the wealth. He was in the top 3% of wealth in the United States of America and had the ears of presidents, had the respect of presidents. Now, how did he do that? Did he do that because he cried in front of his hurdles? No, he did that because he jumped his hurdles. And you know, there has been injustice all over the world. There's always going to be injustice, unfortunately. We understand that. When we understand that, when we understand that concept and quit trying to blame and just do our best to jump our hurdles, we can do amazing things. There are some that say that the repression is just so bad, but we've got some incredible examples of people in every minority of accomplishing great, great things. Herman Cain, born and raised in a time when blacks were totally mistreated, and they were mistreated by the Southern Democrats. Let's get that straight. They were mistreated by the Southern Democrats. And if you don't believe it was the Southern Democrats, and if you believe in the malarkey that the parties have switched sides, all you have to do is look at that first Nixon election and look at George McGovern. Who was the racist in that election? George McGovern was, and he basically gave that election to Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon would have never won had George McGovern not taken those five southern states. The Southern Democrats were racist. And as we go through life, we look at people like Herman Cain. We look at people like Alan West. We look at some great survivors who were hurdle jumpers. That's the difference. It didn't have anything to do with the color of their skin. It didn't have anything to do with oppression. It had to do with what they did with that oppression. They jumped their hurdles. They said, I don't care if I've got less opportunity. I don't care if I've got more hurdles to jump. I'm just going to jump them, and I'm going to make the best. And that's how you end up with an Alan West, being so strong of character and being such a great man, because his hurdles were bigger than my hurdles. Yeah, they were. He grew up in a time where blacks were mistreated in many ways, and there was racism, real racism. Not just because you disagree with one side of politics, you're a racist, but actual people that did not like somebody because of the color of their skin. They didn't like those people. Now, we don't have that so much today. The left would like to say we do. I am in contact with thousands and thousands of conservatives, and I don't know any of them that don't like people because they're black or that they're Mexican because they're Mexican. They don't like illegals illegally crossing our borders. What country in the world does? There's no other country in the world. You get shot at most countries, no matter what color you are, if you cross the border illegally. We don't in the United States. We don't shoot people for that. But you have to have secure borders. But that doesn't make me a racist. I got three nieces that are half Mexican, half Hispanic, half Latino. There's not a racist bone in my body. You know, Dan, when I was in high school, my best friend, Rashonda Smith, was black. And I went to a school that was one-third black, one-third Portuguese, and one-third cowboy. and you know, Rashonda and I didn't care what color skin each other was. We didn't even – I mean, it was just a part of it. She's darker than I was. I was lighter than I was. And we used to have so much fun messing with each other's friends, because we'd go walking through a group of her friends or a group of my friends, and Rashonda would just turn around to me and look at me and go, Scott, we got to get you some sun, boy. You got to be dark like me. You ain't got no sun. Mm-hmm. We laughed because her friends didn't get it. Her friends didn't get it. There was not a racist bone in either one of our bodies. She didn't care what color I was. I didn't care what color she was. She didn't blame me for stuff that happened 60, 80, 100 years ago. I didn't blame her for all the ills in the world. We just loved each other. We were best buds. But we've got a mentality in this country of, instead of jumping your hurdle, laying down in front of your hurdle, crying about it, blaming everybody else, and that's what makes the difference between a success and a failure, no matter what situation you are in life. You know, after the Great Depression, nobody really had any real freedom. The economy had basically taken a lot of freedom away from everybody. And who survived? The hurdle jumper survived. No matter what color you are, the hurdle jumper survived. Throughout history, there have been times of oppression, and we call them out all the time. Dan, you and I call out the oppression that's going on in Cuba. We call out the oppression that was going on the east side of the Berlin Wall. But what do you do with the hurdles that come to your life on a personal basis? You lay down and cry in front of the hurdles. Because, you see, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and that group have spent decades telling the black community, blame, 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 try and get what you can. Everybody owes you something. And that has not gotten them anywhere. When they needed people saying, yes, we've got problems. Yes, let's try and fix them. But while we're trying to fix them, you jump your hurdles anyways. You do the best you can anyways. Give it everything you've got, because you can do it. We've got examples, and we could start listing them over and over and over and over and over again, of people that have started from all colors of skin, from all social classes, who has started with nothing and ended up with a whole lot. Look at Oprah Winfrey. And I don't always agree with Oprah Winfrey, but, man, what a mighty fine hurdle jumper. Because, you see, the bigger the hurdles, the stronger you are. If Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton had spent the last 40 years telling the people, jump your hurdles, jump your hurdles, jump your hurdles, you would have a black community stronger than the white community now, because the bigger the hurdle, the more you jump, the stronger you get.
The white community hasn't had all those hurdles. We'd be weaker. But there's a mentality of blame and cry in front of your hurdles. I try and teach that with the kids on a daily basis, Dan. They're always saying it's too hard. And I say, well, it's supposed to be hard. The harder it is, God only gives you what you can handle. The harder it is, when you jump your hurdle, the stronger you're going to be. The bigger the hurdle, the stronger your legs. And that's the mentality that is missing from the left. Boy, I hate injustice. I want everybody to have a good life. I want everybody to have the American dream. And I know that not everybody has at all times in this great country. I think we've come a long, long ways. Especially in the last 40, 50 years. There was some atrocious things going on. We got little groups, and they're little groups like the KKK, which, of course, one of the greatest Democrats that ever lived, Robert Byrd, was one of the chief KKK members. And they've done some abhorrent things over the years. We've had different people that looked at the color of somebody's skin and just didn't like them for that reason. I think that's abhorrent. But, you know, I face the exact same thing today. I'm a Christian, and the atheists treat me the same way. I have firm beliefs. I'm a conservative. I'm a conservative white male. People make fun of me. People tell me I'm stupid. I laugh, and I jump my hurdles, no matter what they are. And I've had some huge hurdles in this life to jump. I've made some of my own hurdles that I had to jump. Some hurdles are just natural part of life that you have to jump, and some hurdles people have put in my way. Those are the three different kinds of hurdles we have. But it's all in the mentality of how you jump those hurdles. You know, one of the things when I was teaching sales in Grenada, which was a wonderful place, I was the only white person on the whole side of the island of about 3,000 people in that area I was at, and I had more fun than a barrel of monkeys. They poked fun at me and laughed, and we kidded, and we had a great time. But in teaching sales, when I'd gather, I'd have 750 people in a class. I have the whole team there in class. And I always used this illustration, and it's a funny one. Remember the movie Ladybugs, Dan, with Rodney Dangerfield? And Rodney Dangerfield played a guy who was interested in this woman. He had his girlfriend, and she had a son, and he played soccer. And he ended up taking over and coaching the girls' soccer team, and he talked his girlfriend's son into dressing like a girl and playing on the girls' soccer team. It was called Ladybugs. It was a hilarious movie. At the beginning of that movie, Rodney Dangerfield has just come from a motivational speaking meeting, and he's looking in the mirror as he's driving down the car, and he's saying, "I'm great, I'm awesome, you can do it," something to that effect. I'm not quoting exactly right. "I'm great, I'm awesome, you can do it." And you know, that was the big thing that I did down there when I was doing motivational speaking, was getting the people to understand they can do anything they set their mind to, no matter what the hurdles are in front of them. And some of the people that I talked to had a great telephone voice. When they went to do some customer service, they flowed real well. Some people had to really struggle with it. But no matter what, I told them all, you can all succeed. Some of you have to work harder at it than others, but you've all got the ability to succeed if you just decide in your mind you can do it. Well, no, we've had especially in the black community, a situation where, I'll tell you, I'm with Jesse Lee Peterson. The majority of the problems today that are in the black community is because there's so many black boys, black sons being raised without a father figure. They're gone. In fact, it's almost cheered when a guy's got 13, 14 kids and he's not really raising any of them. And they're being raised without any father figure in their life. That's a huge problem. But even those kids, if they have been taught the mentality, if their mother will teach them the mentality of jump your hurdles, instead of turning around and crying in front of your hurdles, they're going to succeed.
You're going to succeed. There is no reason. Even in, let me tell you, and a great example, you go to the Old Testament and you go to the story of the Israelites. They were slaves there in Egypt. And they succeeded. They succeeded to the point where Pharaoh said, we better start killing these people off. They're liable to take over us. We're hurdle jumpers. And we can look throughout history, and we can always see that there is an injustice. There's always going to be injustice. 300 years from now, 500 years from now, if the world lasts that long, there's going to always be injustice of some kind. And it's unfortunate. There's been times in this great world where people were severely, severely oppressed. But within those people of oppression, you've got two different kinds of people. The kind of people that jump the hurdles and do their best, and the people that lay down in front of the hurdles and cry in front of the hurdles. We're Frederick Douglass Republicans, Dan, because we believe wholeheartedly in hurdle jumping. Frederick Douglass believed certain things that are very vital. He believed in the Founding Fathers and the Constitution. He believed that limited government was better than overreaching federal government, large government. He believed in the sanctity of life. He believed in some basic, basic concepts. He was a hurdle jumper. And he probably jumped more hurdles than anybody in this day and age, no matter what color you are, have to jump. You know, in this day and age, we've got so many opportunities. We don't use them. We don't use them because we sit back, and America as a whole has become lazy because we got so many things that have taken away a lot of our hurdles. You know, men and women 100 years ago, when they became adults, were pretty strong. Why? Because they had to get up in the morning and milk the cow and collect the eggs in order to have breakfast. Or they had to walk 30 miles in different places in order to accomplish the task that they needed to accomplish. And they were stronger because of it. We have, you know, we got the microwave. We push the button on the microwave for a minute, and then we get impatient. We have the ability, no matter what race you are, no matter where you're living in life, no matter what class you're in this great country, to accomplish great things. You know, I've said it for a long time. If a person's out of work, there are so many opportunities. If you'll just use your head, go down to a swap meet and get yourself a lawnmower, and you spend a couple of days walking around your neighborhood, knocking on doors, and asking if you can start doing lawns. And you'll find people that will be willing to let you do that. A little bit of hard work will really pay off because you can make a good $20 to $30 an hour mowing lawns. We have got lots of examples of men of many different backgrounds who have created entire businesses. I got a friend in California who happens to be black, by the way, who about 30 years ago decided he liked to paint, and so he got himself a little bit of equipment. He got himself a few buckets of different things, different paints, and he got some paintbrushes and so on and so forth. And he went around the neighborhood asking if he could do some painting, some touch-up and repainting jobs. Had some white paint. They needed some spots fixed and so on and so forth. And that immediately bloomed into people having him paint their whole entire houses. Today he's got 25 trucks and a multi-million-dollar business. But he had to put a little bit of effort and a little bit of work into it. And it didn't matter what color he was. He had that opportunity to get out there and do that. Everybody's got the opportunity to do that in this great country. Have some people, have the white people had a little bit more chances sometimes in this great country? Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, our history is not the best. No one's is. But the thing is it's better than most. Better than all. You can go anywhere else in the world. Go to Africa. I would encourage anybody that thinks that this great country isn't great, you go to Africa and just type in YouTube, Africa Starving Children. our poorest of poor in this country are in the top 10% of wealth of the world. Our poorest of poor have absolutely incredible opportunities. Our people that are on welfare have 2 and 3 cars, computers, so on and so forth. And Dan, I think we've used up our time. We're at the top of the hour, and there's my rant. Are you there, Dan?
I'm still here.
Okay. So I'll pass it to you for a few closing remarks on that, and then we'll go ahead and play some Red Skelton.
Okay, I agree with you 100%, and, you know, don't let anything keep you back. Set your mind and go for it. And if you see an obstacle, you see a hurdle, take advantage of it. Jump over and grow stronger. And the world is yours. And with that, we'll close off with Red Skelton and his wonderful pledge.
I remember a teacher that I had. Now, I went through the seventh grade. I went to the seventh grade. I left home when I was 10 years old because I was hungry. And I used to, this is true. I work in the summer and I go to school in the winter. But I had this one teacher. He was the principal of the Harrison School in Vincennes, Indiana. To me, this was the greatest teacher, a real sage of my time, anyhow. He had such wisdom. And we were all reciting the Pledge of Allegiance one day. And he walked over, this little old teacher, Mr. Laswell was his name. Mr. Laswell, he says, he says, I've been listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word? I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity, allegiance, my love and my devotion, to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom, wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United. That means that we have all come together. States. Individual communities that have united into 48 great states. 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose, and that's love for country. And to the Republic, a state in which sovereign power is invested in representatives chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people, and it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people. For which it stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation, and justice, the principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America,
and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance: under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer, and that would be eliminated from schools too?